In the first hour of the program today, we'll spend some of our time talking a little bit about the work of the sex researcher Alfred Kinsey and how that has shaped the way that we think about sex, particularly as the way we think about female sexuality and what Kinsey had to say has to do with or how it touches on feminism. And our guest for the program this morning is Elizabeth Gross. She's in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University and is visiting the campus, is here, has spent a couple of days. She gave a talk in the MillerCom series. This was last night. And as I said before the news, we over the years have had many of these people on the show because they're always interesting. And we think it's good to bring them and their ideas to a little bit larger audience, not simply the people that can go and attend the talks, but people who are outside of the university sphere and don't ordinarily do things like that. As we talk in this first hour, of course, questions, comments are welcome. We invite people to join the conversation. We just also ask people just to try and be brief, just so we can keep the program going and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455 is our number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just a little bit in way of background about our guest. Elizabeth Gross was born in Australia, in Sydney, and was educated there at University of Sydney. Her academic background is in philosophy. She also taught there and then at Monash University in Melbourne. In 1998, she came to the United States. She was at SUNY Buffalo. She also has been visiting professor at a number of other universities around the country. And in 2002, she joined the faculty at Rutgers. She is perhaps best known for her work on psychoanalysis and feminism, although has written on other subjects as well. And thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's really my pleasure.
You know, one of the things I guess that strikes me about Kinsey, when you think about him and his work, is that even though it's been, give or take a few years, 50 years now since his big works on sexuality in men and women were published, and then he only lived a couple of years after the second book, the book on female sexuality, was published.
Right.
So he died in 1956. So his books have been out there for a while, and he's been gone for a while, and yet when people talk about him as an individual, talk about his work, it's as if this was just yesterday. Particularly when you look at the kind of the level of venom that some people have for him as an individual, who he was, what he wrote about, how he went about doing his work, and what they feel are the implications for that kind of a discussion of sexuality. And it just strikes me that to be remarkable that so many years after he did this work, that it should still be such a hotly debated subject.
Well, he had the right topic, I think. The question of sexuality is something everyone is fascinated about. Everyone has an angle on. Everyone is curious about. And I think most people have an investment in seeing it one way or another. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is fascinating that from the moment there was an inkling of what kind of research he was doing, there was an immense controversy. And it still hasn't abated. I think it's probably even stronger now than in the past.
Well, I know one of the things that you've thought about is just how it is that he and other people approach the study of sexuality and how difficult a thing it is to study in that way, that in this sort of sense, that like other physiological processes, you can take people and you can stick electrodes all over their body and you can do things like measure their pulse and their respiration and their blood pressure and, you know, all kinds of things like that. Things that you can reduce to numbers and you can crunch in computer.
And
you can
exactly
do that.
That's exactly what Masters and Johnson did.
And that's what they did. And yet at the same time, sexuality, it's not like digestion. It's not a process like that. Yes, you can do that, and that might indeed tell you something, but it seems like what you're arguing is that it goes much beyond that. And if you try to reduce it to numbers, then it may be that what it is has gotten away from you completely.
Well, I think what you do when you measure it is you flatten it out to its lowest common denominator. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think it's true of digestion too, that when we look at digestion, it's a kind of boring process. But when we look at eating, eating is as culturally rich, as invested with desire, passion, fantasy, horror, as sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I think it's exactly analogous, that if you reduce eating to digestion, you lose what's really essential about the pleasure that we experience, or sometimes the horror we experience. Mm-hmm. So there's something about sexuality that electrodes will never understand.
Yeah.
And I think Kinsey understood that, and that's partly why he devoted so much effort to hearing people's reports about their sexuality, talking to them in great deals and a great deal of detail about their experiences, looking at their writings, looking at photographs, images, pictures, representations.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, one of the things that made his project so controversial, that he looked at such disparate material. He wanted to generate a technique by which he could measure this material. But the material was richer than his technique for looking at it. And that material reasserts itself over and over again.
Hmm. I suppose that's also one of the grounds on which he's been criticized. I think ever since, people have looked at his methods and said, we have some problem with this in the sense that, well, probably for a number of reasons, but maybe one of the main things is that it is based on a relatively limited sample. And while he did sit down with people, he and his researchers did sit down with people, as you say, and it wasn't simply a matter of saying, oh, tell me how many sexual partners you've had and how many times do you think you've had sex in your life and, you know, how did you do it and what did you do, all that sort of stuff, which he, of course, was interested in.
Yes.
But it was much more than that. These really long, kind of free-form, very detailed sort of interviews,
yes.
Well, where they were trying to, you know, tease out from people all this stuff about their sexual history. Things that, of course, people are sometimes not particularly inclined to talk about. And I think people looked at it and said, well, you know, that may tell you something about those people that were the subjects, but does that really tell you something about people, about everybody?
Well, I think what he'd planned to do had he lived longer was to expand the scope of this research. So he very specifically targeted local groups, cults, fraternities, sororities, cities, small villages, so that he'd try and get 100% of the population of those groups. His goal was to, in the long run, ideally, to survey everybody.
Hmm.
But even if he had, I'm not sure that he would have come to what is essential to sexuality. And even if he had, I don't think that those critics of his would have actually been satisfied. Because it was not simply the smallness of his sample, it was the way he was addressing the questions. So, for example, he didn't say, have you had a homosexual experience? The question was, how many have you had? Which would allow one to say none,
mm-hmm.
but it would presume that there was a possibility that one had some. And so the answers were much more likely to be open to, yes, I have, than if he'd simply asked the question, have you had such experience? Mm-hmm. And I suspect that it's the subtleness of his questioning, his methodology, that offended many people.
Do you think that the significance of what he did is both simply the fact that he did it, the idea that he was trying to, he had this idea that sexual behavior was something that could be studied in a scientific way and perhaps should be studied in a scientific way. Is that as important or more important than the actual data that he presented, which admittedly I think everybody would say, well, there may be some flaws with it. You might want to there'd be some disagreement about how much. Some people would say a lot. Some people would say, well, not very much. But I guess at the end of the day, which do you think is more important, what he found out or the fact that he did it in the first place?
Look, I think he wasn't the first to try and undertake these surveys. There was quite a long history from the end of the 19th century through to the 1950s. I think what was contentious was what he actually discovered. And what he discovered was that the rate of promiscuity was much higher than it seemed, the rate of homosexuality was much higher, the rate of perversion, the rate of bestiality, that the comfort level of a normative sexuality was unsettled by his work. What he made clear was that sexuality was not nearly as straightforward as most people assumed, that almost everybody was implicated in some form of weird sexuality at some point in their lives. And I think this was terribly unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Elizabeth Gross. She's on the Faculty of Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University. She's here visiting the campus. We're talking about Alfred Kinsey and about his studies on sexuality. And questions and comments, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Is there Is there some way in which his enterprise was characteristic of the time in which he did it? And could, if we did that again today, if there had been no Kinsey, but now here in 2004 we decided we're going to embark on this study, would we do it differently?
I have no doubt we'd do it differently. I mean, of course, there have been surveys much more recently. Scheer Height, I think, is the most well-known of the more recent speculators on sexuality of large populations. So I have no doubt we'd do it differently. But I think such a survey at the moment wouldn't be nearly as explosive as it was at the time. And I think it's because he wrote at a moment when, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, when we had a belief that science could actually explain everything to us, and where the belief in the rationality of mankind was so strong that he believed that if we could just present the data, then people would stop persecuting sexual minorities, sexuality would become open, sexual misery would cease, marital adjustment would rise. So he had this belief that the truth would somehow liberate. And I have a feeling that that's very tied to a particular moment in the 1950s. That by the time we get to the 1960s, when his work has really had a strong cultural impact, there's an immense amount of cynicism about the value of science. And I think this is partly because of the atomic bomb and the testing of bombs and the growing sense of the immense potential danger of science if it's left unchecked.
When I seem to recall that when Scheer Height, when her work was published and written about, that some of the, it seems that a similar kind of criticism was leveled against her. People said her methods were not good, that she had some particular agenda to promote, that, you know, that, and I guess I wonder whether you think that anyone approaching this subject would end up facing that same kind of criticism, and for the reasons that are obvious, that is because the whole subject of sexuality and sexual expression is so charged and so we're so conflicted about it that any kind of really open discussion of it will draw criticism.
I think that's certainly true, but I also think that it's because it's such an immensely complex phenomenon that any analysis of it can only deal with part of sexuality. So, I mean, what Scheer Height did, her survey was a good deal larger than Kinsey's. It still generated controversy because it's not as if we can come up with the actual truth of sexuality. And even providing statistics about frequency and rates and so on tells us only one small angle about sexuality. So what interests me is the fact that there's something about sexuality itself that defies thorough knowledge. And indeed, maybe that's a good thing, that there's something ineffable about sexuality. It's not that we can't know a lot about it. We obviously can, and we're learning more and more about it, and we're learning about its physiology, its sociology, and so on. But what none of these surveys can approach is the level of desire. And they haven't attempted to. What they've attempted to do, what Kinsey explicitly said, was he was looking at sexual behavior. But sexual behavior is what you see from the outside. And sexual desire is what you experience from within. And there's something really difficult and intangible and unsettling about that.
And will that, you think that will always be the case? That as much as we would talk about it and think about it and try and talk and get people to talk about it, that it is likely that will always be in unknowable.
I think that there will always be something unknowable about sexuality, and personally I think that's a very good thing. I mean, it keeps the allure of sexuality going. It's a mystery. There's something subterranean about it, and that's partly because we don't know ourselves, even though we experience it directly. We don't know what it entails, what it means, where it leads to. There's something unsettling about desire. One of the things I said yesterday in the lecture is that our sexual identity is defined not by our sexual history, but by our next sexual encounter. And there's something really fundamentally open about our next sexual encounter. Essentially not for everyone, but there's always a question mark about where will it lead me.
Well, we have some callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll start with someone in Urbana on our line number one.
Yes, good morning. I want to thank our guest and also Focus 580 for having the Millercom people on your program so often. Some of us just can't get down to campus, so really appreciate having the Millercom people on. And my question was about the Sherry Height survey. I know I read it. I bought the book. I read it. And, you know, I have to admit, I can't remember a whole lot. Does this professor remember anything? And did it corroborate the Kinsey report? And I'm trying to think, was the Kinsey report focused mainly on males? I was a little young to have read it. So I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, to answer the second question first, Kinsey wrote two volumes, one on male sexual behaviour and one on female sexual behaviour. The male volume was published first, the female second, and they were two massive texts. And I think one of the great things about Kinsey was that he realised that he couldn't do a single volume dealing with both sexes adequately, and that some of the questions and some of the issues must be different in dealing with the two different sexes. I think in many ways Sher Height did confirm a lot of Kinsey's insights. I haven't read Height for a long time, but I remember the thing that was most shocking about her work at the time it was published was her argument that 70% of women didn't orgasm from so-called normal heterosexual intercourse. And that, in fact, confirms, I think, to a large extent, Kinsey's understanding of intercourse. And it's that that I suspect generated a tremendous amount of controversy around Height's position, mm-hmm. Because the implication is that perhaps the usual missionary positions of sexuality weren't in fact satisfying for women. Hmm.
I guess I'm also stretching my memory of this, but wasn't there also some discussion around the issue of women in terms of things like premarital sex, extramarital sex, and they're, in a sense, making the case that in terms of their sexual activity, their sexual desire, you know, how much they wanted sex, how much they thought about sex, that maybe there wasn't quite as much difference between men and women than we might have thought.
Yes, and I think that's true, but I also think that's partly because of the mediation of Masters and Johnson between Kinsey and Sher Height, that what Masters and Johnson ended up arguing was that instead of the big gulf that Kinsey seemed to presume, they argued that the physiology of sexual response was more or less identical in both sexes. Mm-hmm. And I think that Height was very influenced by Masters and Johnson, and I think that she was very interested in showing the similarities. And in a way, this is probably why, at the moment, I think I prefer Kinsey. When Height wrote, the question of egalitarianism was really central in feminism, and the idea that women were largely the same as men was one of the most important feminist principles. But I think since Height's early work, which is in the mid-1970s, there's been a great deal of effort devoted to thinking about the differences between the sexes. And it was Kinsey that was really prescient about the idea that you couldn't assume the couple as the model by which you understood sexuality.
Yeah. Just talking for a moment more about Masters and Johnson, because I talked a little bit earlier about the fact that raised this image of studying sexuality by taking people and sticking electrodes on them and then having them have sex and measuring them, all the various kinds of things you can measure. And I think that that's, when I think of that, the people that I think of are Masters and Johns. I mean, you think of how many times do you see them photographed wearing white lab coats?
Yes, that's right.
That these were the people that they were. It was almost intentionally trying to use all of the kinds of symbols that they could to say, we are scientists. This is a scientific enterprise. We're going to do this that way. And in what ways do you think they were like Kinsey and were doing what Kinsey had done and what other people had done? And in what ways were they doing something that perhaps hadn't been done before?
Well, they were like Kinsey in that they believed that science would provide an answer. But the kind of science I think they developed was really different. Kinsey actually developed a kind of social science. Like, he rarely looked at physiology. He has one chapter on neurology, but he looks at other sources. He doesn't do the research himself. I doubt that he wanted to have the image of the same sort of physicist model. And he was a botanist. So I doubt that he was interested in presenting himself as a kind of physicist or as a doctor, which is the way Masters and Johnson presented themselves. So in many ways, you know, of course, Masters and Johnson, I think, are the culmination of that scientific tendency that Kinsey opened up and made public. They reduce his project very much. They reduce basically the body to physiology. They reduce desire to behavior.
Oh, let's take another caller here. Bloomington, Indiana, on line four, the home of Mr. Kinsey. Hello, go ahead.
Hi. Did you say that Mr. Kinsey was a botanist?
He was an entomologist.
He was a zoologist. He was an expert on gall wasps, and therefore he was totally unqualified to investigate human sexuality, because he was not a psychologist. And because his research dealt with the basis of our society. It dealt with marriage and the family. So you got research in a critical area that needed to be very accurate, needed to be stringently peer-reviewed. Kinsey's research was none of that. As a matter of fact, you've already mentioned his sampling errors, but his errors were worse than that. The very distinguished psychologist Abraham Maslow, you probably remember Maslow's pyramid. Maslow criticized him because he says when you're dealing with sexual matters and you're interviewing, that's how Kinsey did his research. He interviewed people, and by the way, he didn't keep any written records of his interviews. There was no formal questionnaire. Kinsey just kept the questions in his head, and to remind him what the interviewees had told him, what the subjects had told him, he had a code. He had a little code he'd marked down, but it was a private code, so nobody else knew it but him. And Abraham Maslow says, look, when you're interviewing people about their intimate sexual behavior, those people who are promiscuous or those people who have unconventional sexual appetites are likely to brag or invent sexual adventures that have never happened. On the other hand, people who are modest will possibly not want to talk about their sexual activities at all. They will maintain a normal modesty, and probably won't tell you some of the things that they've done. Kinsey made no provision to deal with that kind of distortion, and Kinsey's biographer, James Jones, who by the way is a historian, and he says that Kinsey was not just simply he was not unbiased. He himself was a serious sexual deviant, and in his search for sexual research subjects, when he was ostensibly searching for sexual research subjects, he was also searching for sexual partners. He let his own sexual exploits affect his findings. So I mean, this guy is an embarrassment. When all you have to do is look in some of his books. He has tables which supposedly show how many orgasms a 5-month-old baby can have, and then an 11-month-old baby. Did you know that a 2-year-old child can have 11 orgasms in 65 minutes? It's right here on table 34. And when you look at that, you say, Dr. Kinsey, how did you find out? How did you find out those statistics? And he had to admit, well, we asked some pedophiles. We had pedophiles abusing children. That's criminal activity. I mean, the man is an embarrassment, and his research findings should definitely not be taken seriously.
Well, the caller certainly raises a number of points, and I don't necessarily expect you to be a defender or an apologist for Kinsey. But I'm interested in what you think, you know, particularly about the question of can you really get people to tell you accurately about their sexual history, and do you worry that either some people will tell you things that they didn't actually do, and that other people will not tell you about things that they really did?
Look, I have no doubt about that, but it's not at all clear to me that he understood the data as the truth. He talked a lot about the possibilities of exaggeration or denial and so on. Mm-hmm. This was information that was the data that he transformed. Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm not particularly interested in the accuracy of his results. What I'm interested in is their cultural effects. And I think one of the things that's interesting is he has been accused of having a biased sample. And maybe that's true, I don't know. Only another survey that's broader and more multi-focused would be able to tell us that. But what I do know is that if you don't interview pedophiles and perverts and deviants, then you don't get an adequate picture of the range and scope of sexuality in any particular country. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that you need to take that as the truth. But if those subjects are excluded for any particular reason, then you don't get an accurate picture of the mores and sexual practices of a culture.
Mm. And I guess that this is, and fairly recently, this is one of the criticisms that has been leveled against Kinsey, particularly by a writer named Judith Reisman,
yes,
who has written a lot about particularly this issue, making the accusation that somehow Kinsey was a party to child abuse. And all one can say is that Kinsey's defenders say that what he was doing was he did interview pedophiles and he asked them about their sexual history. But child abuse was not taking in front of Mr. Kinsey as he sat there taking notes.
And more than that, if one doesn't take into account child abuse, which is a form of sexuality for the abuser, even if not for the child, then one still disavows or forecloses, unfortunately, one of the major areas of sexual expression. So I can't really criticize him for doing that. I think that in a way that was one of his profound insights, that unless one looks at the intensity of sexuality in all its expressions, one doesn't understand what sexuality is.
Yeah. We're past our midpoint here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We have some other people who are waiting. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Elizabeth Gross, is on the faculty in Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University and has written about a number of subjects, including psychoanalysis and feminism. She's here visiting the campus, gave a talk last night on this topic that we're discussing here this morning about Kinsey and sexuality. And questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Eureka next in line. This is line two. Hello.
Interesting program, David. I realize you made the statement that you cannot quantify sexuality in just in terms of statistics, but I was curious to the statement that you had made about how his statistics findings shocked apparently the American culture of that time when it came out. Could you maybe give three or four, such as premarital, extramarital, homosexuality, and I believe you talked about bestiality, I guess, would be considered perversions of the statistical outcomes of that survey?
Do you want details about those statistics?
Yes, I
don't have them.
I'm
sorry. Look, the one thing that I do remember that was very striking and that I think caused a good deal of outrage at the time was that Kinsey argued that 17% of rural males had had sex with animals.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. It's a pretty shocking statistic. And, look, I have no idea of knowing whether it's accurate or not, but that was immensely controversial. I think the idea that there was a good deal of extramarital sexuality going on, not only on the part of men, but also on the part of women, was also quite shocking to the sensibilities of the 1950s.
This would have been a time that I think probably American culture, at least officially, could have been considered quite puritanical. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. You only have to look at the fragments of television programs, Leave It to Beaver and so on, that are slightly later, that have this idea of the wholesome, innocent family where sexuality is largely in the service of reproduction.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. I think that in addition, one of the things that he concluded was that something like 10% of the population was homosexual.
Yeah, that's right.
And that, again, caused a lot of controversy, making this argument that 1 out of 10 people. Now, I think since that is one of the figures that has been certainly has been questioned, and I think today a lot of people would say, well, maybe it's not like 10%, it's maybe more like 1 or 2%. But again,
this is very controversial because the circles in which I mix more or less affirm that it is 1 in 10.
Really? Well, and again, this may be, you know, given the level of stigma that we attach to homosexuality, it's going to be another one of those things that's going to be difficult to get people probably to talk with you about.
Look, I think that's true, but Kinsey did something very interesting in relation to homosexuality, and that is that he produced a scale, a kind of moving scale between heterosexuality and homosexuality. And what he ended up showing was something like, and I don't remember the exact statistic, but something like 80% of people had had some homosexual experience. Now, that didn't make them homosexual. They could be on the heterosexual sort of end of that continuum, but nonetheless, if 1 in 10 was exclusively homosexual, 8 in 10 had some access to some kind of homosexual activity at some point in their lives. And that, I think, is a very unsettling figure, especially for those who believe that one's sexuality is fixed, given a single thing.
Yeah, you're one thing or the other.
Yeah.
There's no in between.
Yeah, well, what he ended up showing was the majority of people are actually somewhere in between.
To another caller here. I think the caller is in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Professor Gross, I'd be interested in knowing more about your current work. And you talked about Kinsey and him being in botany or zoology or biology or science, and you're in psychoanalysis and you say you're not a scientist. And I'm just wondering, do you study culture, history, personal history, language, discourse? You know, people talk about, and quote, imaginary body, that sexuality isn't just about, you know, the biological body. So how do these, how does the, quote, body interact with the psychological?
Okay, that's a great question, and indeed that is one of the questions of the last 200 or 300 years. I guess what I'd say, and this is me talking in my voice rather than talking about Kinsey, is something like this, that the self, the psychological, is a kind of phenomenon that results from the complexity of the body. So it's not as if we have a self that is separate from the body. The self is an angle on the body. It's a unification of the body and an expression of the body. So it's not as if we can have a notion of who we are or what we are outside of our bodily form and outside the activities that our body enables us to undertake. I'm actually not a psychoanalyst either. I'm a philosopher by training. And sadly or happily, that means that I largely deal in abstractions. And abstractions like the category mind or the category body. And I think what's really interesting is that the moment we think of those two things separately, mind and body or self and body, it's very, very difficult for us to bring them together again. So we need a model which will allow us to think of the mind and the body as it were, two different angles on one and the same thing. And I think that's what sexuality allows us to see and experience, that sexuality is our embodiment, but it's also our desire.
And so how does this body then interact with other body psyches or with a culture or a superstructure or, you know, that kind of thing? And also then I'd like to ask you about American culture and what you're observing there in terms of disciplines or control of sexuality. But
Well, that body and subject never emerges alone. You can only be, the body can only be a subject when some other subject recognizes it. So the subject that emerges out of the body is always a cultural and social phenomenon. There can't be a subject in isolation.
They're always in relation with something else.
That's right. And they emerge to be entities only because they're in a relation with other entities.
So can we talk about female sexuality or male sexuality or homosexuality? I mean, are these behaviors or identities or...
I don't think they're identities, although many people think they are identities. I think they're histories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They're compression of all the things that we've done in the past. But more than that, I think our identity is also the potential we have for the future. It's not only how we have acted, it's how we could act.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's been extreme change in the last, since the Kinsey Report, for example, in Anglo-American or world culture?
Yeah, look, a huge change. I mean, when you ask a question as broad as this, one can say, of course, there are major continuities. But I think if you look at social life, and particularly at the expression of sexual life, there has been a huge transformation. The majority of people in the United States at the moment don't live in two-parent families. The majority of people in the United States have premarital sex. Although gay marriage remains an immensely controversial topic, gayness is now, to some extent at least, culturally acceptable. These are quite major, I think, sociological changes over the last 50 years.
And has this produced anxiety or...
Yes, but I, look, not being grown up in the 1950s, I don't know how much anxiety there was there, but I would bet my life that if you thought you were gay in the 1950s, you'd be a lot more anxious than now.
No, I really meant on the part of people who feel that this rapid change is causing extreme instability and they may be reacting against that.
Look, honestly, I don't know if from 1950 to the present the change was more rapid than from 1900 to 1950.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know if that's true, because I have a feeling that maybe the first half of the 20th century changed even more dramatically.
But the fear in to these changes seems to be greater.
I don't know if I agree with that, because, like, imagine living in the 1950s, where suddenly the capacity to destroy the entire world was unveiled. I think there was immense insecurity in the 1950s, especially after the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that the general cultural anxiety level has dropped a bit since then.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm an optimist.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to Urbana for another caller. This is line three. Hello.
Yes. I wonder if Professor Glass would talk about her book, Feminism and Psychology, or was that Feminism and Psychiatry?
It was psychoanalysis, actually.
Ah, okay. Feminism and psychoanalysis. I'd be interested in hearing about that if you have time.
Yeah, look, the book was called Jacques Lacan, A Feminist Introduction. Lacan was a French psychoanalyst. And basically what I argue is that psychoanalysis gives us quite an accurate description of the way in which patriarchal cultures contain female sexuality. So what I'm suggesting is that the psychoanalytic model is a good description of female sexuality in a patriarchal culture. But ideally, if patriarchy is somehow overcome, we don't know what the future of female sexuality might be. I mean, that is a really, really summarized, compressed version of the book.
Ah, thank you. That's fascinating. And are there any hints of what female sexuality might develop if patriarchy were not as pervasive as it is now?
Look, I think there are, and I think that they're provided. According to psychoanalysis, they're provided by the kind of sexuality that we commonly don't regard as sexuality of children. Freud talks a lot about infantile sexuality, and he calls it polymorphous perverse. And this means that multiple parts of the body give multiple forms of pleasure without any particular hierarchy. And I have a feeling that if we have any resources to have a different kind of sexuality, those resources have to come from our earliest years.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Elizabeth Gross is our guest from Rutgers University. She's on the faculty there in women's and gender studies. I'm interested in going back and picking up a point that you mentioned, and if I'm incorrectly, if I heard it wrong, you can correct me, and that is that perhaps within feminism, or maybe within feminist scholarship, there would have been a time, and particularly this would have been during the second wave of the 1960s, when there was a lot of stress being put on how men and women are alike.
Yes.
Is it the case that now we're in a time where that has changed, and in fact we're going back to talking about ways in which men and women are different?
Okay, I can't really talk universally, but I think there has been a kind of change in feminist theory, particularly over the last 15 years, where the question of difference has become much more essential than the question of egalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways it's kind of obvious with the turn to questions of the body that the bodies of men and women are obviously different. And if they are different, what does this actually mean? Not about relations of superiority and inferiority, but relations of experience. How do the two sexes experience things if their bodies are structured differently and function differently?
Mm.
And I think people were very worried about the idea of difference in a previous generation, because difference always meant inequality. But equality itself presumes sameness. It presumes that there's a measure by which you can calculate these differences. So what I and a number of other feminists are trying to do is to think of a kind of radically incommensurable difference, a difference that isn't comparable. Like, each sex is autonomous in itself. Each sex has its own perspectives and representations. And it's not clear that they're directly complementary with each other. Mm-hmm. They may be, but they may not be.
Yeah. I think this is really interesting, but I'm also concerned that some of the people who are listening won't have any idea what it is you're talking about, and because I'm not completely sure myself. I mean, if you can reduce this, and I'm sure that other people who do the kind of work you do maybe grab onto what it is. But is there a way in a much sort of simpler way that you can explain what you're talking about?
Okay, look, I don't know if I'll do it as simply as I can.
Okay.
When we talk about the difference between apples and oranges, we have these two entities that we already think we know. And to contrast or compare them, we already know what they are. Now, I'm suggesting that in the case of men and women, we can't know from a position outside of being a man or a woman. Like, there is no third position. Or if there is, that godlike position is not one we can occupy. So in a way, there's no outside position from which to compare the two sexes as given fixed entities. One can only do so from the perspective of being one of those sexes. And I think a good deal of feminist theory has said that the bulk of knowledge, theory, representation has been developed from men's perspectives only. And so it's time now for the development of different perspectives, which may or may not clash.
Mm-hmm. Well, have not we been doing that for about the last 30, 40 years?
We've been doing it for less. I mean, I think that for the first 20 years of second wave feminism, feminists were trying to say, we're just as good as you are. And I think it was only probably from the early 1980s that feminists were saying, well, why do we want to meet your criterion anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are other values that we should aspire to.
Mm.
Maybe that's not what we want to succeed in your terms.
Yeah. Do you see that as a, I don't know if maturity is the right word, but as a sense in which another level hit within feminism and feminist thinking, another level have sort of been gained in a sense a kind of a further step?
Yes. I think that the position now is more complex than the one before. I think the earlier position was something like there's only one set of ideal values. There's only one ideal position, and that's that which is occupied by men and that women should have access to as well. And I think now the complexity is that there are not just two sets of interests, there are a multiplicity of interests. And it's not clear that there's a hierarchy anymore.
Hmm. I think, you know, when you get people talking about how things have changed as a result of feminism, particularly that feminism that we're talking about, and how we think about gender and how men and women relate to one another. It's difficult because it seems that on the one hand, we can talk about all sorts of ways in which things have changed, and many people would argue have changed for the better. And yet, it seems in other ways, things have not changed one bit.
Yeah, look, I think things have changed a lot if you're not 16. Okay, and I think there is something really horrible about the teenage years that to some extent everyone experiences, because that's the moment at which you've got to decide, am I going to be myself or am I going to be what's expected of me or something else? And in a way, the moment of conservatism that repeats over and over again the structures of oppression, I think occur when one is, I don't know about 16, but when one is in the teen years, when one doesn't know exactly yet where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling that after those years, there's much more opportunity. There are much more options available for both sexes.
It seems that, though, the pressure that comes from society, and maybe even the pressure that comes from oneself, to conform to some idea of what it is to be a man, what it is to be a woman, how you're supposed to behave, how you're supposed to relate to one another, and everything that means in all spheres of your life. It just seems that that's, it's very difficult to get past all of that programming that you've gotten all the way up until you're, 20 or 30 or 40 or whatever. I mean, that it's still there, and it's a very difficult thing. I mean, sure, you don't have the pressures that you face when you're 16, when you're 50, but in some ways I'm not sure that things change all that much.
Well, clearly you don't have the same pressures, but the point is when you're 50, you've made a set of choices about what you think your life should be. And when you're 16, what you have is simply what's around you that's expected of you. And I think, in a way, the reason that some feminists are very pessimistic is because one actually has to repeat with each generation the same kinds of insights one had the last generation, that you can't sustain a kind of conceptual struggle except if it's relived again in the next generation.
Yeah. And even though it seems that now people who are having children have gone through that, I mean, people who have been born since, 1960, in as much as they raise questions and actually maybe think about gender, think about men and women differently than their parents and their grandparents.
Yes, yes.
And you would think that kind of thing would get incorporated in the way that they raise their children.
It does, to some extent. And the horrible thing about parenting is that you have only so much control. And in fact, peer pressure is immensely stronger in the teenage years. And so there's this great normalization, this wave of normalization that occurs when kids finally realize that their peers actually define them more than their parents. Mm. And it's at that moment, I think, a great wave of conservatism tends to come over people. And they have to struggle to resist that norm.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably even harder today with mass media so focused on teen culture.
Yeah. And when you use the phrase conservatism, I guess what I'm assuming that you're talking about is very simply the idea of conforming to group norms.
That's right.
It's
that's
like
right.
Wanting to be like everybody,
that's right.
Not wanting to stick out, but
that's right.
To be blending in with the group.
In a way, that's, of course, the definition of teenagehood, that you really want to be part of the group that you've chosen.
Just going back to the subject we started talking about at the beginning, sex and studying sex and thinking about sex. I guess I'm going back to the idea that in as much as people from time to time, Kinsey and Masters and Johnson and other people have said, we think that we can study sex scientifically and that we can find ways to measure it. And express that in tables and charts and graphs, and in our discussion that maybe ultimately that's not going to be successful. That yes, maybe you can learn some things that way, but that ultimately there is something about sex and sexuality and sexual behavior that's unknowable, that we cannot describe that way. Having said that, do you think that female sexuality is more ineffable than male sexuality?
I think at the present, absolutely. Okay, certainly at this particular moment. I personally don't think it's true, like, physiologically. Mm-hmm. I think partly the problem is that the research methods that have been developed were derived initially from male sexuality and then simply transferred into the analysis of female sexuality, and they're not appropriate. So I think one of the tasks ahead is really to define different methods, different techniques for analysing, for assessing, for addressing female sexuality. So, I mean, the point is, one of the problems that Kinsey faced was that he could only measure female sexuality through orgasm, but he was perfectly well aware that there were many incredibly pleasing sexual experiences for women that didn't lead to orgasm. Now, he didn't quite know how to address that. And that's, I think, partly because his method wasn't actually subtle enough to deal with the issues that arise from the experience of female sexuality.
Mm-hmm. And you think that that's not as true for men?
Look, I'm sure it's true for men. I'm sure it's true for men, but I think it's less in men's interest to change the methods by which sexuality is understood, because I think the dominant image of male sexuality is exactly linked to counting, to conquest.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another caller here before we find ourselves out of time in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've only caught the last half of this program, so I'm not sure if this has been asked yet, but I was wondering what your theory or how your theory fits in for transsexuals.
Okay, good question. What I'd say is this, that transsexualism arises in the same way that all other kinds of sexuality arise, and that is, it arises in the context of a family structure where the meanings of mother, father, male and female are all linked. Now, what seems to occur in transsexuality, transsexuals experience a discontinuity between how they feel and how their bodies look and are regarded by others. Now, I certainly don't think there's anything abnormal or anomalous about the transsexual impulse, because I believe that our sexual images are all derived from identifying with our parents primarily, or in the first instance. Is that the kind of thing you were looking at?
I guess so, because you're talking about the how there's only, you know, there's one sex and there's the other sex, and we don't have knowledge of either, or we don't have a third sex. So I was just wondering, from the context of a transsexual, who's actually experienced both sexes?
Well, I think the tragedy is there isn't a third sex, and what the transsexual tries to do is to accommodate two sexes in one body. But there isn't a third sex. What there is are indeterminate categories between the two sexes, and biologically they're known as hermaphroditism. But transsexualism is not a hermaphroditism. It's a psychological attitude to one's body.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. We are just about at the point that we're going to have to finish. Do you think there's anything really interesting going, you know, in the heritage of people like Kenzie Masters and Johnson Sherhide, you know, people like that? And presumably we will continue to. I know that also some number of years ago there were some researchers at the University of Chicago essentially tried to do the same sort of thing, do an inquiry into people's sexual behaviors. And as difficult and as loaded and as controversial as that all is, I presume that we will continue to do that, and the next generations will have people who will be doing it.
I'm quite sure of it, given our fascination with the topic of sexuality and given our uncertainty about who we are. We want to know. Hmm. The question will be, how do we know? In what ways do we know?
Well, I thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Giving you some of your time. Our guest, Elizabeth Gross, from Rutgers University. She's on the faculty there in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies here visiting the University of Illinois.